Asha versus Department of Justice, Ms. Chaffetz.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Samantha Heifetz on behalf of the appellant. The documents at issue in this FOIA suit were all created by the trial team of Department of Justice attorneys in the course of representing the United States in
CERCLA. Did the judge look at any of these documents?
There was not an in-camera review performed, as far as I'm aware.
Well, shouldn't he have?
Here the question presented is strictly a legal one. So
I don't understand strictly a legal one. It's a legal question about a bunch of documents and whether they should be produced to the adversary. And you'd think the judge would like to look at them, and you know.
Well, the judge here wasn't making a decision that these documents.
The question is where these two little sections in the Environmental Division of the Justice Department are, you know, real antagonists and go head to head against each other the way private firms do, or whether they're cooperative, and right, isn't that the issue?
Well, the way that the district court approached the issue,
why wouldn't the district judge want to look at the documents and, you know, see what their character is?
Well, the district court didn't express any interest in doing that kind of in-camera review, I think, because the way the district court thought about the question was as a broad question of waiver. And so the court wasn't making any kind of determination that the EES and EDS attorneys had in this case conducted themselves antagonistically. Quite frankly, there's no evidence of that. And if anything,
the judge didn't look at that. We haven't looked at those. We don't have those documents. How do we know whether there's?
Because we know how the Department of Justice is organized and how government litigation works.
No, we don't know how the look, all we know is what the judicial code says. We don't know how the what we do know is that there is no warfare as bitter as turf warfare. And for all I know, you know, one set of lawyers identifies with the EPA and the other with the Corps of Engineers, and they go at each other just like adversaries.
Sure.
Maybe that wouldn't be dispositive, but it would be
That is exactly the point, Your Honor. It would not be dispositive because
may I ask this? If the trial judge were to review and analyze the documents, would he need to have some special expertise or some understanding of what he's looking at?
The documents that are at issue here, we're talking about, for example, memoranda that were written jointly by EES and EDS attorneys making recommendations about whether or not the government should proceed with a proposed consent decree to their shared leadership, to the Deputy Assistant Attorney General who oversaw both divisions, to the Assistant Attorney General who heads the Environment and Natural Resources Division, ultimately to the Associate Attorney General of the United States. So there's been no question in this case about some notion of these entities not collaborating in the way that they are required to, both by the United States Code and by Department of Justice policy.
Suppose you have a multi-party private litigation, you know, a number of different plaintiffs, number of different defendants, and they decide, you know, quoting Benjamin Franklin, we either hang together or we'll hang separately. And so they decide they'll have a committee and, you know, they'll have a single counsel and he'll resolve any disputes among the defendants. So the defendants go at each other and try to blame the other and exonerate themselves. But in the end, the sole counsel, lead counsel for each side, resolves these squabbles among his clients. So would this principle you're urging here apply equally there?
Well, Your Honor, I do think that that is important to note how different of a case that is. But there is a doctrine of common interest that if it were appropriate, the parties in that case might invoke. So privilege, common law of privilege, does account for scenarios where separate parties decide that it is in their common interest to proceed jointly. And yes, Your Honor?
Why doesn't the same rule apply?
Well, this case is far simpler. We don't have separate parties here. We have a single party before the court, the United States.
Legalistic.
Well,
single party versus separate party. You have one subordinate unit that's aligned with the EPA, and others aligned with the Corps of Engineers.
Well, I think that
one is the prosecutor, one is the defender.
I think that that articulation, which is the one that's been advanced by the plaintiffs, is undermined by the very facts of this case. It's actually not an accurate description of this litigation, for example. Here we have EPA in its capacity as an enforcing agency with its interest in seeing that the Superfund be restored. But we also...
In its capacity as a polluter.
If I might, Your Honor, we also in this case have EPA as a potentially responsible party, as one of the named parties potentially responsible for pollution. So EPA itself certainly is not aligned in any singular fashion with EES or EDS.
I'd like to shift the blame to the Corps of Engineers.
But, Your Honor, that's not the case. Well, here, even in plaintiffs' articulation of the interest in this case, I think even the way they've articulated it really highlights what's going on here. They say, look, the enforcing agencies are interested in seeing that all of the potentially responsible parties pay.
Except
fair enough.
Themselves.
All of the... Well, that's not right, Your Honor, because... They do want to make sure that the Superfund is restored completely, and that includes their partial responsibility. Now, brings us to a second fact that's relevant here.
Minimize their responsibility.
Ultimately, the amount that's going to be paid here isn't coming from EPA's budget or the Army Corps' budget. It's coming from the Judgment Fund.
These agencies are very protective of their reputation and so on. Corps of Engineers is criticized a lot. Well, you know, held responsible for Katrina and so on. So they don't want to be branded as a polluter.
Well, if I might, Your Honor, you note reputation, and EPA's reputation obviously compels it to want to make sure that the federal government in its entirety, including its own role, are held responsible.
But, and, of course, if these documents can be disclosed and are not privileged, it certainly interferes with the free dialogue and discussion on both sides in terms of the merits or non-merits of a particular argument, whether the government is at fault, not at fault, who's at fault, because if we're in a situation where these are not privileged, it might have a chilling effect on the dialogue amongst the lawyers, and we end up...
Absolutely.
The
privileges that are at issue here are all meant to facilitate the kind of...
That's a good point. I don't know why you resisted in the example I gave where you have private parties rather than government agencies.
Well, Judge, I don't mean to resist it. I mean simply to say that this is a simpler case because we really don't have separate parties. Here we have the Department of Justice appearing on behalf of the United States. And it happens to be the case that attorneys who were staffed by the Attorney General for this case happen to have come from two sections that have the names of the Environmental Enforcement Section and the Environmental Defense Section. Now, just to step back for a moment, there's a lot of fluidity in how the Attorney General staffs litigation. So in a small case, an EES attorney or an EDS attorney may handle both the affirmative and defensive claims. This happens to be a large case. And so, you know, in a U.S. attorney's office, for example, if this were handled out of a U.S. attorney's office, as often happens, you'd have one civil attorney handling both affirmative and defensive claims. This happens to be, as this court has often noted, huge litigation, long-standing litigation. So here we have the Attorney General choosing to bring in attorneys with, you know, different areas of expertise and experience, but they are all Department of Justice attorneys. And this is really important here, and part of what makes this an easier case than Your Honor's example, because here they do have statutory, regulatory, and policy-based responsibilities to represent the overall interests of the United States, not the parochial interests, as the Supreme Court has called it, of any single agency. So while EPA and U.S. Army Corps of... Sorry?
It's so unrealistic.
Which aspect, Your Honor, would be unrealistic? I apologize for not...
The notion that everyone's pulling together in the federal government instead of it's being a set of warring fiefs.
If Your Honor's proposition is that you can't imagine a world in which EPA and U.S. Army Corps of Engineers are cooperating...
I find that hard to imagine.
I would urge you to consider the fact that that's precisely why the Department of Justice...
Engineers is about building things, and it's completely different from a regulatory agency. I mean, it has regulatory responsibilities, but it has a very different orientation and culture from the EPA.
Sure, Your Honor, but this case is about communications between DOJ attorneys from the Environmental Enforcement Section and the Environmental Defense Section. These are all of the materials at issue are things they co-wrote or that they exchanged with each other in the process of coming to the Department of Justice's position as to how this litigation should proceed. They're strategizing about their representation of the affirmative and defensive claims of the United States. Now,
okay. your time is expired.
Can I just ask one question,
yeah, sure.
Judge? The district court held that you had somehow waived the attorney-client privilege. Is that right?
That is indeed the analysis that this entire opinion was based on, was that we had waived all of our litigating privileges.
And he was wrong?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
And that is why?
Because his entire analysis that we had waived all of our litigating privileges was based on the notion that it constituted waiver for the DOJ trial team attorneys who were representing the U.S. in this case to talk to one another. Why? Because they happened to come from two different sections of the Environment and Natural Resources Division. And the United States' position is that that cannot be right. It would, as Your Honor noted earlier, eviscerate all litigating privileges for the Department of Justice really across the board, because we are always, as DOJ, in the position of having to reconcile competing concerns. Often agencies...
Always. Don't say always.
Well, many, many cases present this problem where there are competing concerns, and it is the long-established role of the Attorney General and of the Solicitor General to do that work of reconciling. And in fact, I appreciate your time, Your Honor.
So, Mr. Rubino.
Good morning. If it pleases the court, my name is David Rubino.
Did either side ask the judge to look at any of these documents?
He did, Your Honor. In fact, we urged the court to conduct in-camera review of all of the documents. That was resisted by the Department of Justice. And that was the reason why the in-camera review was not conducted of the documents that are issued.
Give some size of what would have been a submission. What would the trial court have to do?
We had narrowed down our request to approximately 440 documents. I can't tell you the total number of pages that would have encompassed, but probably somewhere less than 1,000 pages. I'm sorry?
That's a lot of pages to read.
Proceed.
Well, so what was the judge's response? Did he give a response or just didn't do it?
The judge decided not to conduct in-camera review because...
Reasons, I mean?
Because the Department of Justice had urged, one, that they could make some preliminary presentation on why Exemptions 5 and 7A to FOIA otherwise applied, and then that they believed that the summary judgment proceeding would be the more appropriate means of resolving the issues. And so,
I understand. What was the judge's reason for not looking at least some of the documents?
Because the judge wanted to see a preliminary presentation that the Department of Justice had offered to make with regard to why the documents that were at issue were entitled to be withheld. And after that submission was made, there was another court conference with all the parties, the transcript of which is part of the court record. And in that discussion, it was decided that the department again urged that summary judgment.
Did the judge say why he didn't? Why didn't he look at that? I don't understand.
The judge simply
did he
said.
Ever give a reason.
He did not. Other than
okay,
he thought it was more appropriate to consider summary judgment.
Let me ask you, what is it you hope to find in these documents? What would be the best thing you could find?
The best thing that would be found in the documents is a demonstration that the Department of Justice didn't comply with the mandates of Section 120 of CERCLA and ensure that they treat federal PRPs in the same manner and through the same procedures as they treat private PRPs.
Okay, in other words, that there was collusion.
Correct.
Yes, but if there's collusion, then but you're playing into your opponent's hands, because if there's collusion, then there is an adversity, right? So your argument is that these two sections in the Environmental Division are, you know, like different parties in litigation. They're antagonistic. But what you're looking for is evidence that, no, they're actually collusive.
No, well, we're looking...
And that's what your opponent says. He didn't call it collusion, of course, but says, you know, they're working together to do something that is in the overall interest of the perceived by the Justice Department. So I don't see how your case is helped by getting access to these documents.
Because the Attorney General, first and foremost, is required to ensure that there's fair and even application of the federal environmental laws to all parties. CERCLA 120 says...
But that's nothing to do with two of these sections going at each other.
Well,
that's your only basis for getting access to the documents, that they're just like two separate parties.
No, except
they're like two separate parties, and they're not colluding.
Well, except the federal PRPs are not to be put in any better position than a private PRP.
That's not the basis for waiver of attorney-client privilege.
The basis for the waiver of attorney-client privilege is when adverse parties...
Yes, but you're saying they're not adverse. That's the whole problem. They collude with each other.
No, we are saying that they're adverse. What we're looking to show is, in fact, that they didn't represent the adverse interest they have.
Okay, so then they're not adverse.
Well,
you've got two. You're saying they're... I don't really know what you're saying, but you're sort of suggesting, well, they ought to be adverse. They ought to be going at each other hammer and tongs, but they're not. Instead, they're colluding to try to put all the costs on private parties, right? But if that's true, I don't see what the basis is for waiver of attorney-client privilege.
Because the waiver of attorney-client privilege arises when adverse parties in litigation exchange confidential information between themselves. If my client...
But they're not adverse, according to you.
But we would
colluders.
Argue that they are adverse.
No, they're collusion. You say they're... That's what you're looking for, collusion.
Well, I don't... Then I should rephrase that. I wouldn't say I'm looking for evidence that they colluded, but the fact of the matter is EPA is the enforcing agency, should seek to impose the maximum amount of liability on every PRP, federal or private, in the same fashion. And a PRP should defend against that in the same fashion. So the interests of the U.S. Army Corps, as you noted, and as the court below found, are adverse to the interests of the enforcement arm of EPA. And if they're not treating themselves as adverse parties in litigation, then they're not following the mandate of Section 120 of CERCLA.
If they're not adverse in litigation, then there's no basis for a waiver of the attorney-client privilege.
If the court were to make a finding that they were not adverse, then that would be correct, but they are adverse.
You said they were not adverse. You said they should be adverse, but they're not. They're cooperating.
No, we believe that...
The department's entire argument.
I'm just not tracking this at all. I mean, it's like one attorney general that makes one decision. It's not like we've got two tracks. You know, we have that one section, and then we have the enforcement lawyers, and we have the defense attorneys. And then, like... Somehow there are two separate decisions made. Then I could follow their adverse. But this all melds into a decision by the Attorney General.
And our point is that there should be two tracks.
To what point? So this can then spill over to other divisions in the Department of Justice. Let's say you've got a TAC division type case. A TAC division is trying to make a decision or a determination about a case. And then in the criminal division, there's a RICO, some kind of investigation going on RICO, and then the lawyers in the RICO section don't want the tax case to proceed or have some issues with the tax case. And so, I mean, I'm just worried about the implications of this. I understand we're talking about EPA now, but to open up discussions and conversations between lawyers in various divisions, I mean, this could go way beyond just this section. I just am not buying this.
The department in this case, again, there's a statutory requirement that they treat PRPs fairly and equally.
I understand the statutory requirement, and I understand that may be different from other departments, but I'm just saying this would just open the door for...
Well, it doesn't necessarily have to open the door because, again, this is in part of statutorily driven. Second, what we're talking about is how the information that goes to the Attorney General, who ultimately decides what the litigation position of the U.S. should be. There's no reason why two divisions couldn't independently and aggressively develop the positions that they have for their respective agencies. They can write memorandum. They then go to somebody, either the Attorney General or a delegate below.
Yeah, but the basis of those memorandum, I assume, are reports they've received from the Corps of Engineers, information that's been gathered. That kind of information is certainly available to you in civil litigation, the documents that were relied on, the reports by the engineers, all those underlying documents upon which the lawyers make certain recommendations or judgments, that is available, correct?
Assuming that they're publicly available, yes.
Yeah, and assuming there are subpoenas that are issued and the government is being honest and provides the basis for it. So you can still get to the same problem. You know, perhaps the government isn't being as diligent, not evaluating it in a fair way, putting too much of a burden on private parties versus the government. You can still get the underlying information that leads down that path without having the internal memoranda of the lawyers from different divisions.
Well, but in this case, one of the issues we have is that the releases and the covenants not to sue being provided to the federal government PRPs are broader and more expansive than those that are provided to the private PRPs. That's not supposed to happen under CERCLA, under Section 120 of CERCLA. To the extent it's occurred...
can argue that. What do you need the documents for?
Yeah, you can argue that because you can say, here's what the private parties have, here's what the government has, theirs is too broad, it's an error, theirs should be tighter, and here are the reasons why, and the reasons why are based upon the reports and the underlying data that you have.
It's difficult to comment on what we otherwise would be in the documents without seeing them. We believe that there would be relevant information and that there's been a waiver of the attorney-client privilege because two adverse parties in litigation shared confidential communications.
How much of a showing do you have to make in order to obtain the information you requested?
Well, for the attorney-client and the work product privilege waivers, it would be the same as would be in the course of ordinary discovery. And one of the issues we had in this case is discovery hadn't been started because the answers hadn't been filed in the underlying action, nor was there a scheduling order. With regard to the law enforcement exemption, that would be subject to whatever the appropriate rules are under FOIA for that.
Can you make this claim for information open the door to what goes on behind the scenes for some positive purpose? To get the information and be complimentary, or to satisfy the public that the proposed consent decree is meritorious?
It would be that the proposed consent decree was, and the terms of it were reached in an appropriate and fair manner so that the federal government is being kept on the same level playing field that all other CERCLA litigants are on.
Okay, well, thank you
very much.
So, Ms. Chafee, your time expired, but you can have time if you have anything further.
Sure. I'll just highlight a couple of quick points, Your Honor, and obviously if there are any questions from the panel. I think we've hit upon the key points in these last few moments. We have a chain of command that leads up to the Attorney General. Plaintiffs don't dispute the fact that the Attorney General and the Attorney General's delegates can review all of these materials without raising any problems of waiver. Their position is basically that somewhere down the chain of command, the rules of the game change, and suddenly there's a requirement of this kind of segregation. But that distinction has no legal basis. There's nothing in CERCLA or elsewhere that would require or infringe upon the AG's prerogative to staff cases as he sees fit. Their argument is animated by a notion of what the litigation and what government practice should look like, as opposed to what it's actually required to look like by federal statutes, regulations, and DOJ policies. Their vision would ultimately deprive the AG, as Your Honor noted, of the ability to really get the kind of efficient, effective, full story of what's going on in litigation that's so important to government practice. And as Your Honor noted, Judge Posner, the district court really was animated, and plaintiffs' arguments are animated not by concerns about adversity, but concerns about what you might term and what you termed collusion. And here there is a process in CERCLA for having the district court evaluate the fairness, the reasonableness of the proposed consent decree. The government bears the burden, along with the other proponents of the consent decree, of establishing the fairness of the proposed settlement. So the government, in the CERCLA litigation, put forward spreadsheets describing the government's math. Plaintiffs have had access to the underlying data. So, you know,
could the judge, as part of his fairness determination, look at these documents?
If the judge thought that that was necessary to evaluate, that might be possible. Here we would say that it's not necessary because they are privileged.
If he's not to look at the documents, what does he look at?
Well, we've already put forth significant materials in defense of the consent decree. We've put forth all of our mathematics. We've put forth, I mean, this is, we're talking here about opinion work. Everything here is covered by attorney work product. We're talking about memoranda by DOJ attorneys about litigation strategy. We're talking about analyses of the data internally about the appropriateness of going forward with the settlement. So we don't think that it is necessary or would be appropriate for the district court in any circumstances to look at that. Whether he thinks he needs more information to rule on the consent decree, he has discretion in those proceedings. But the government has already put forward the underlying data, put forward our mathematics, defended these numbers. Indeed, this court, the Seventh Circuit, recently in the Appleton decision, looked at some of the same reports that are at issue here and upheld the privilege in a FOIA challenge. So the defendants in these cases have,
in that case, the information was disclosed by DOJ?
No, Your Honor. So in Appleton, some of the same reports relating to this underlying data, but reports that include our analyses of the data, they were not disclosed.
Was it privileged?
Either in discovery or FOIA, they were privileged attorney work product, just as all of the materials here are covered by attorney work product.
Well, in that case, DOJ disclosed privileged information?
No, Your Honor, we did not disclose it, and the district court ruled that we didn't have to disclose it, that the materials were privileged, and this court, the Seventh Circuit, affirmed that judgment recently.
So the bottom line is the data, which is critical for making judgments and evaluations, was available and is available, so that when the evaluation is made on the settlement,
that's right,
private lawyers can look at that data, form their opinions, argue to the court, this isn't supported, this math calculation by the government isn't accurate, there's problems with this report. Everybody's got the data. What you're protecting is the analysis of lawyers in terms of how this is all evaluated.
So absolutely.
In terms of fairness, that's where the fairness is ensured, that the documentation and the data, the underlying data, is provided.
That is correct, Your Honor.
Was this proposed consent decree ultimately finalized?
It's before the court. The court,
in a proposed form.
That's right. So per CERCLA, the district judge has to determine whether or not it's reasonable and fair and has to pass on the consent decree. It has been lodged with the court. the United States is not the only party to the consent decree. The state of Wisconsin, the natural resource trustees, several municipalities are also parties to the consent decree. It's been lodged.
It has not been delayed that ultimate decision.
That's right. He's holding it pending this decision. It's the same district judge in both matters. So he's been holding it. Thank you for your time.
Okay. Well, thank you very much to both counsel.